I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Eve Posen, co-author Pirkei Imahot, The Wisdom of Mothers, The Voices of Women. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shin Shinim Bar El Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. While we have been commemorating the 50th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem for several weeks now here on Two Jewish, the actual American calendar date for the half-century mark since the Six-Day War falls this coming week, from June 5th to June 10th. The Hebrew calendar observance was over a week ago on Yom Yerushalayim, the holiday celebrating the reunification of Jerusalem. In preparation for this anniversary, we began exploring the consequences of that decisive, miraculous victory for Israel over the armies of five Arab nations back in 1967. As you certainly know by now, Israel in that war ended up capturing the old city of Jerusalem and its East Jerusalem suburbs, the whole of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, and the entire West Bank of the Jordan River. The results were shocking and amazing at the time, and the long-term impact of these territorial and human changes has been profound. And they are still very relevant today, those changes. Just last week, President Trump chose to delay the process of moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv, which is not the capital of Israel, to Jerusalem, which has been the capital city of the Jewish state since December of 1949, shortly after Israel was formed. Well, each of the last four or five U.S. presidents has vowed to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. That's presidents of both parties. And each has welched on the promise. Trump is apparently joining the lengthening line of those who prefer to pretend that the real capital of Israel is not the capital, lest they offend those who hate Israel and democracy. In any case, here on Two Jewish, we began this review of the effects of the Six-Day War by examining the question of the Old City of Jerusalem and its holy sites a few weeks ago, as well as East Jerusalem's Arab neighborhoods. We explored the Sinai and the durable, if cool, peace with Egypt that resulted from exchanging it for a treaty, talked about the Gaza Strip and Golan Heights, and the good and bad choices Israel has made over the years in dealing with each area. And last week began analyzing the large question of the West Bank, home to the majority of the Arab population that came under Israeli auspices after the Six-Day War. The Israeli control of this area began when the Jordanian army attacked Israeli positions and civilian areas in 1967, and the Israeli army, in hard fighting, drove the Jordanians not only from Jerusalem but from the entire West Bank and Jericho. At first, Israel didn't know what to do with the West Bank. The whole Jewish nation was deeply relieved that the narrowest part of the country was no longer just 9 miles wide or so. But what exactly was going to happen with this large area that lay between Israel's north and central regions? And how would the substantial Arab population residing there respond to Israeli rule? There wasn't really any way to do things except set up some sort of military governance, because the Jordanians had withdrawn, and the Arab residents of the villages and towns had no general governmental structure. And the Arabs imprisoned in refugee camps by the Jordanians for the past almost 20 years certainly didn't have the capacity to provide the services of a functional society. The Israelis didn't initially think they would be in the West Bank permanently, certainly not for 50 years. They believed Jordan would exchange land for peace, a deal with Israel, sooner rather than later. But that, of course, didn't happen so quickly. In fact, no official treaties of any kind were signed with Jordan until the 1990s. And so for the first 20 years or so, Israel controlled the West Bank in a kind of loose-ish military rule. From 67 till 1987, the West Bank was under military control by Israel. While terror attacks certainly were perpetrated by Palestinian groups, in general, most of the West Bank remained fairly quiet. Israelis traveled easily to and within the West Bank, and many West Bank Arabs worked within the areas that had always been Israel, where most of the jobs were. For the first decade after the Six-Day War, from 67 to about 77, Israeli settlement activity in the West Bank was actually quite low. Although substantial building took place in Jerusalem and its environs, and some settlements were authorized and built in the Sinai and in Gaza, Israel did not authorize much major construction in the West Bank, except in areas very close to Jerusalem. That policy began to change in the late 70s and early 80s as Israel's government changed. Increasingly, land was allocated for subsidized Israeli building projects in the West Bank. Much of the construction, interestingly, was actually done by Palestinian workers who found employment with Israeli firms doing the work. The number of Israelis living in the West Bank went up and then went up a little more, but still it was not gigantic by any means. I recall driving through the West Bank in a small Fiat rental car for about a week during the summer of 1987, traveling with friends. While it would feel uncomfortable in some areas, there was no great sense of danger or hostility. The West Bank essentially felt like it was a loose part of Israel in those days. The vast majority of Israelis who lived in the West Bank, though, were actually clustered pretty close to the original boundary lines of Israel. Most of the area was Arab, under what seems today like rather loose Israeli control. All of that changed dramatically in the fall of 1987, just a couple months after I was there, when the First Intifada exploded. Suddenly, the West Bank was not at all a safe place, not for Israeli civilians, not for Israeli settlers, not for isolated IDF troops, and certainly not for tourists. Biblically part of the land of Israel, or not, it was now a hotbed of anger and anti-Israeli violence. I recall a rabbi I worked with describing that First Intifada, which lasted until the early 1990s, as the birth pangs of the state of Palestine. Well, it wasn't quite that, but it changed many Israelis' minds about the practicality of keeping the West Bank as a permanent Israeli secondary territory. In effect, during the First Intifada, Israelis lived mostly within the old Israel, at least as far as the West Bank was concerned. By 1992, talks had begun in earnest between Israel and the various Arab countries, and eventually with the Palestinians themselves, that led the Oslo peace process. At the height of that optimistic period, Israel offered to give the Palestinians approximately 93% of the West Bank, as well as all of Gaza, for their new Palestinian state. That would have left the vast majority of the Jewish Israelis who had settled in the West Bank in a new, slightly extended permanent Israeli territory, while giving the Palestinian Authority nearly all the land that it wanted. Israel had already shown the ability to withdraw from and forcibly dismantle its own settlements. Settlements in the Sinai were disbanded by Israel when it was given over to Egypt following the Camp David Accords, and later settlements in Gaza were taken down and evacuated, some forcibly as well, by Israel. Well, under the Oslo process, a variety of new divisions of the West Bank were worked out. Some remained fully under Israeli military control. Some were under a mix of Israeli and Palestinian Authority control. Some were under almost complete Palestinian Authority control. It more or less worked, at least for a while. But tragically, as soon as full peace actually loomed on the horizon, the Palestinian leadership, headed still in those days by the lamentable Yasser Arafat, backed away. They could not agree to 93% of the areas they wanted without believing that they would look weak to their own people. And so the Palestinians created, not so spontaneously this time around, a second intifada, even more violent, that destroyed the Oslo process and ended with loss of life in the West Bank and the semi-permanent imposition of military controls. These made life in this large area, populated by well over a million Palestinians, truly miserable. Israeli leadership changed dramatically, too, with Yitzhak Rabin's assassination. The Israeli public's horror at the carnage carried out in the Second Intifada by Palestinian Arab suicide-homicide bombers. Security and a far less trusting and more aggressive approach to Palestinians carried the day within Israel. While Gaza is a mess today, it is perhaps the West Bank that has suffered the most for the failures of the Palestinian leaders to embrace peace, and for the hardening of Israeli attitudes and the codification of onerous forms of military control. For cities like Bethlehem and Nablus and Shechem and even Hebron, well, they could be economically successful, as Israeli Arab cities within the old borders of Israel have become so. And there is good farmland and the potential to attract industry. But today, 50 years after 1967, it's hard to find hope in the West Bank. The best and brightest Arab students leave for the West or for better jobs in Gulf states. Christian Arabs, a substantial part of the population in cities like Bethlehem and elsewhere, have almost all fled out of economic frustration and fled from religious persecution by Muslim Arabs, too. Traveling in the West Bank today, it's hard to believe how close peace and cooperation seemed just 20 years ago, and how far away it seems to be now. There isn't, sadly, an easy solution. But then, this is the Middle East. It can always be worse, and no one ever promised that the resolution of these complex situations in the Middle East would be easy. On a happier note, and to play us in this morning, here's a song of the era of the Six-Day War, 50 years ago this week, the classic Lach Yerushalayim, a song to Jerusalem, which is still the most amazing place in the whole world.
Lach Yerushalayim, bein chomot ha'ir. Lach Yerushalayim, or hadash ya'ir. Ve'libeinu rachir. Yerushalayim lo gdumim ba'od lach Yerushalayim lach razim ba'sod belibeinu belibeinu rachir et harkayam lach Yerushalayim ben yaden ba'yam.
That was Lach Yerushalayim, I sing to you, Jerusalem. Between the Jordan and the sea, in our hearts, you are always first. Our guest this morning is a young congregational rabbi who worked with an elderly co-author to create a new take on Jewish wisdom. Rabbi Eve Posen's new book is called Pirkei Imahot, The Wisdom of Mothers, The Voices of Women. Meet her and find out how women see Jewish ethical wisdom differently when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
We welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Eve Posen is the co-author of Pirkei Imahot, The Wisdom of Mothers, The Voices of Women, a new book that parallels, I guess, the ethics of the ancestors, ethics of the fathers. But also goes some very different directions. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you.
So tell me how this book evolved, because there was a certain evolutionary process to it.
Yeah, so I started at my job in Portland, Oregon as a rabbi of education, and I put out the call to congregants, come learn with me. I called it learning a la carte. Basically, you choose the topic, you choose the place, you choose the people, you choose the time, and I show up. And about 9 months into the program, my co-author, Lois Schenker, called me. She was recovering from knee surgery and said, I want to learn with you. So I threw out weekly Torah portion, Parshat HaShavua, and she turned that down very quickly. So I did a little research, didn't want to get turned down a second time from her, and found out she liked a really good project. So I said, what if we study Pirkei Avot? But what if we read it from our own personal perspective as women? And then what if we write our own companion piece, Pirkei Imahot? And you don't suggest a project to Lois without your world being turned upside down. And off we went. And so this book is the culmination of 18 months of study of Pirkei Avot, plus conversations with women around the country and the world, really.
So for those of our listeners who aren't tremendously familiar with Pirkei Avot, it's perhaps the greatest hits of the Mishnah, kind of the ethical teachings of the rabbis codified around 225, and the most commonly studied piece of rabbinic text. So it's a very famous text among Jews who study or practice on a regular basis. How did it feel to kind of take new slants on it?
I mean, it felt like when we finished the project, we looked back on it and we said, this is what would have been written in the margins as commentary had the rabbis left any more room in the Mishnah for there to be commentary. Right? When you look at the book of Mishnah, when you study from the book, the pages are filled with Rashi and the other comments. So there's not really a lot of room to write your own personal response to it. And so it felt like when we looked back on it, like, yeah, we finally connected with the text in a way that was able to be read again and again and added to and given this whole new layer to learning, hopefully for many, many, many generations to come.
And there are a variety of other commentaries on it. When you titled it, calling it Pirkei Imahot, The Voices of Mothers, you added a subtitle, The Voices of Women. Can you explain that?
So we wanted very much to make sure that this wasn't just limited to people who saw themselves as mothers. So we wanted to make sure that there was room for women in all phases of life to also add their voice and share their wisdom. So some of the wisdom in the second half of the book, we asked women around the world, Jewish women, to share any kind of wisdom or saying that they received from another woman in their life. So you've got wisdom of aunts and teachers and grandparents and best friends and doctors and you name it, any advice that came to you from a wise woman so that it's accessible across the board.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Eve Posen. Her new book is called Pirkei Imahot, co-authored with Lois Sussman Schenker. When we come back in just a few moments here on Two Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners. with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. In the spirit of this show commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, here's a classic from that period, Bashana Haba'ah. Next year, come and see how wonderful and remarkable it will all be.
Bashana Haba, neshev al hamirpeset v'nispor tziporim nodedot yeladim bechufsha yesachaku tofeset ben habayit lebein hasadot ot tireh, ot tireh kama tov yihye bashana, bashana haba. Bashana, bashana haba. Anavim adumim yavshilu ad ha'erev v'yukshu tzonenim la'shulchan v'ruchot redumim yisu elem haderech itonim yeshanim ve'anan. Oh, tireh, oh, tireh kama tov yihye bashana, bashana haba. Oh, tireh, oh, tireh kama tov yihye bashana, bashana haba. Bashana haba nifros kapot yadayim mul haor hanigar halavan. Anafa levana תפרוס בעל כנפיים והשמש תזרח בתוכן. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבא. עוד תראה, עוד תראה כמה טוב יהיה בשנה, בשנה הבא.
That was the classic Bashana Haba'a for this 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War and its results this coming week. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the elections in France, the Brexit vote in England, and how they were not necessarily representative of any larger themes in the world, just kind of major local issues. The election in the fall here was as big a surprise as I can recall in my life, in which Donald Trump won the presidency and a minority of the popular vote, but certainly solid majority in the Electoral College. Nobody really expected that. I'm not sure that Trump expected that. Let's talk about what your perception of the conditions are that led to that historic change.
Right. I agree with you that nobody expected it, including probably Trump himself. And he recently made that very revealing comment of the presidency is a much harder job than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
you know, clearly a man who didn't expect to become president and wasn't remotely prepared. But I think there is a common tendency around the world to posit an artificial swing to the right or swing to nationalism or swing towards xenophobia or whatever to explain all these phenomena. And I actually think all these phenomena are separate and distinct. And, you know, the right wing was a threat in France. I don't think that everybody who voted for the Brexit would identify as right wing. And I don't think that everybody who voted for Donald Trump would identify as right wing. There are a lot of people who vote on really one question issues, like where does the candidate stand on a woman's right to choose?
Right, on abortion, right?
Right. Or, you know, where does a candidate stand on anti-Semitism or gay rights or whatever? Right. So I think a lot of people voted on one of these single button issues, not so much for Trump as against Hillary. And strategically, it worked out that he won a significant majority of the electoral votes, even if he didn't win the popular vote. And in our system, it doesn't matter. And that should maybe be reexamined, and maybe that institution of the Electoral College is out of date and could be revised. But that's a completely different question from what swept this clearly unprepared person into office, and why so many people who voted for him still think he's doing a great job, in spite of all the fumbles and the stumbles of his first 100 days. There are an awful lot of his supporters who still think he's doing a tremendous job. And that, I think, has to do with a vision of America which caused a lot of people to feel threatened by various changes, by the presidency of Obama, by the possibility of a female president, by repeated and sometimes bogus or exaggerated threats of terror and terrorist attacks. Playing on fears was something that the Republicans did very well at in this whole campaign period. And I think that the vote for Trump was more a reflection of people's fears than of people's aspirations or hopes.
And that comment has been made many times, of course. And often it seems to be the case that people tend to vote and make decisions in their lives. I asked this question based on sort of Jewish tradition. What motivates you more? That is hope or fear? Is it desire for gain or is it fear of consequence? And I think for most of us, in our own lives, it's probably related to fear as well.
Right. And I also think that for all the Jews who thought that we'd be fine with Trump because of his Orthodox son and daughter-in-law, I mean, if they ever open their eyes and judge things objectively, I think they're in for a rude awakening.
We will continue to see. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinit on Israel, Leah Avuno of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Leah.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach. It's just a little bit late for the Festival of Shavuot, which we celebrated last week. It was a wonderful holiday in which we commemorate receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai, but it also has agricultural portions to it. Tell us about your experience celebrating Shavuot in Israel.
So Shavuot in my neighborhood in Kiryat Malachi was full with milk, full with cheese, full with all those dairy foods. I don't know why, actually, but it's really good.
Well, you're not supposed to eat meat on Shavuot by tradition, because even the animals stopped and heard the voice of God proclaiming the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, but we took it one step
Even further.
Yes, and we eat it for like 2 weeks.
Two weeks of cheesecake.
Yeah, my mom, we have to finish it, because if not, then it's too bad. Chaval.
What's the best Ethiopian Jewish dairy dish?
There is a food called fitfit that we eat on Shavuot, every Shavuot, and actually every Shabbat morning too, but on Shavuot it's like every day. It's basically the dabo bread. It's not like the injera, but it's more sweet bread. We make it like crumbs, and we put it with all kind of like cottage and all kind of dairy things, and we mix it and some Ethiopian spices, and it's so good.
Is it sweet or is it savory?
It's right in between. That's why it's so special, you know? It's so good. Maybe I should make it.
I think you should. I think you should make it, even if it's not Shavuot next week. I'm going to ask, we also have Bar Al-Kacher here, and Bar is from a more agricultural part of Israel. Bar, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about maybe some of the agricultural aspects of Shavuot. because it's originally the barley harvest, the first harvest of the year, and it has all kinds of agricultural elements to it.
Yeah, true. So actually in my town, there is a festival of a month. It's called Festival Chalav Udvash, which of course refers from the Bible that we have the land of milk and honey. And all that month, we have a lot of different celebrations in all the other towns in my inside of my regional council. It's called Emek Israel, and we have a lot of things for kids that they could go and harvest themselves, like little agricultural harvesters, and they could drink the wine, they could milk the cows, and it's basically all around the agricultural center of Yifat and Nahalal, which is big kibbutzim.
And it's special for Shavuot because it's this beginning of the
exactly it's beginning of summer season. And it's always like that every year. They bring some musicians sometimes, and they would, it's just a big festival of agriculture for the kids usually.
So it's like a giant version of a county fair, actually.
Yeah, it's a county fair with lots of livestock. So it's interesting
and a great way to train kids too. So some really interesting and a very different experience of Shavuot in Israel than we have here, and really quite a wonderful one. Thanks so much. We will talk next week. We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom. So it's summer now here Yay. In Tucson, Arizona. This nice, cool, lovely June. We finish religious school middle of May or so. Tucson Hebrew Academy ends like a week after or so. Mm-hmm. You know, kids have had a great Jewish experience in those settings, and then it's summer. And what do you do to keep your kid actively Jewish in a time of relaxation?
It's an important question because, after all, we're Jews 12 months, 365 days of the year. And we want to, you know, kind of maintain that continuity of concepts and ideas that were learned, findings that were important, and rituals that kids may or maybe may not love doing. But consistency is key. So there's lots of opportunity in Tucson. First of all, there's programming, right? The Jays got great opportunities for summer camp, and there are other summer camp opportunities throughout Arizona, California, etc.
Lots of fantastic Jewish camps. If you haven't signed up your kid now, it might be too late for this summer, but you should jump on it.
Definitely something to look into. And also, you know, the synagogues shift gears a little bit, and they modify their programming. For example, there's summer shul, there's Chardonnay Shabbat.
Right. So there's some cool twists. 5 o'clock wine, cheese and fruit pre-onig and 5:45 1 hour service, right? Everybody's got their own, at Temple Emmanuel, everybody's got their own sort of approach to making summer services more relaxed and fresher.
Right. And, you know,
Mostly they're air conditioned too, very important.
Yes, air conditioning's good. And you know, let's remember too, as we've talked about over time, the importance of the home. Really, parents are a child's first teacher. And so those things that you do at home are kind of extra significant if you're the main piece of continuity. For example, Shabbat dinner, including the kids in the preparation, maybe having them design some prayer, or if they have a song that they learned over the year that they want to incorporate into the ritual. So there are ways to kind of bring them in and apply some of the learning that they've had, but really getting them involved, making challah together. Mm-hmm. If a parent has the time to do that meal preparation, polishing up the silver perhaps, setting the table, those things really go a long way in terms of the physical experience and the mental experience that kids have. It's that doing piece that we've talked about that's so significant for learning.
You know, we used to act out the Torah portions when the kids were little. You know, they'd have to dramatize them.
Right.
And it's interesting because the summer portions, when you get to Numbers after the first portion of Bamidbar, they're all really, you know, the spies. There's all these great, active, interesting
good stories.
So some of it is just keeping a little bit of something meaningful and Jewish in front of your kids every week.
You know, and there are so many great resources out there. You can also, you can always talk to your synagogue rabbi or,
of course,
you know, the learned
the
amongst
best
your friends.
Source of everything.
But, you know, anybody can kind of jump on a computer and find out what's the portion of the week. What's the focus this week?
And you can find a great commentary on it, and you can find one for kids too.
Right. And they can be the ones to do some illustrating or to do some acting or to do some reading or some teaching at the table.
And they're probably better at looking it up on the computer than you are.
They're the experts.
Thanks, John. We'll talk next week. When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, Hetty approaches her rabbi after the service and says to him, "Rabbi, I have a problem. I bought these two female talking parrots, but they only know how to say one thing." "Oh," says the rabbi, "well, what do they know how to say?" And Hetty says, "They only know how to say, 'Hello, we're prostitutes. Want to have some fun?'" "Oy vey," says the rabbi, "that's terrible. But you know, I might have a solution to your problem. Bring your two female parrots to my house tomorrow, and I'll put them in with my two male parrots, whom I taught to daven and read Hebrew and chant Torah. My parrots will teach your parrots to stop saying that terrible phrase, and your female parrots will learn to praise and worship God and really daven." "Oh, thank you, Rabbi," Hetty replies. "It's a great weight off my mind. These birds are driving me crazy." Well, the next day, Hetty brings her female parrots to the rabbi's house. His two male parrots are wearing their tiny little parrot yarmulkes, sitting on their parrot perches, praying with their little parrot sitters in their cages. Hetty puts her two female parrots in with the male parrots, and the female parrots say, just as expected, "Hello, we're prostitutes. Want to have some fun?" One male parrot looks at the other and says, "Put away the sitters, Moshe. Our prayers have been answered." You see, a sitter is a prayer book, and... Well, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week our portion Bahalotcha from the book of Numbers is filled with a series of incidents and events from the wilderness days, plus a couple of important commandments. It's in this week's portion that instructions are given to create the first menorah, the seven-branched candelabrum that's become the most enduring symbol of Judaism. It's also in our portion that we get the first rumblings of rebellion that will explode into full-fledged revolt against Moses and Aaron, just a few more weeks in the disastrous story of Korach. But most significant in this week's Sedra is a peculiar little story about gossip. Moses has married a new wife, and his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, don't think much of her. They begin to talk about her and about Moses behind his back, circulating rumors and gossip. She's not of the right ethnicity. They don't like her influence on Moses. She probably laughs inappropriately or wears her hair too long. The response by God is swift and decisive. Miriam, although oddly not Aaron, comes down with a dread ailment. Moses' siblings realize the error of their gossiping ways. They repent and are healed. But the point has been made. Gossip and slander are among the most destructive influences in society. If we don't avoid them, we will indeed have tsoras, trouble and heartache. If we can avoid them, we have every chance to build a society of holiness and good. What a great message. As the Talmud teaches, gossip injures three people, the speaker, the listener, and the subject. It hurts the person who gossips, the one who listens to gossip, and the person who is gossiped about. All are morally damaged by the experience of gossip. No one benefits. Circulating rumors, sharing personal information about others, accurate or not, is not the right way to create genuine community or intimacy. Lashon hara, the unethical use of speech, is attractive to many of us, but it's wrong and destructive. There are many other things to speak about, and almost all of them are more valuable. A famous dictum says that great minds speak about ideas, smaller minds speak about events, and the smallest minds speak about other people. May we learn from our portion of Baha'u'llah that the best way to use speech is to build, heal, and learn, and not to engage in gossip. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Eve Posen, explores sharing Jewish wisdom from a woman's perspective, really from two very different women's perspectives, with contributions from still more. Find out how that approach differs and what unique qualities it offers when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jared Kushner, senior advisor to President Trump and, of course, his son-in-law, has become a person of interest in the expanding criminal investigation into the Russian role in influencing the U.S. presidential election that made Donald Trump president. Jared Kushner is now at the center of the inquiry into whether Trump officials colluded with Russia. At issue were two meetings Kushner had back in December during the Trump administration's transition period. One was with Sergei Kislyak, Russia's ambassador to the U.S., and the other with Sergei Gorkov, who runs a Russian state-owned bank and is close to Putin. The meetings were first reported on in March. Last week, the Washington Post said that the meeting with Kislyak focused on setting up a back channel between the Trump transition team and Moscow. As opposed to official communications with other countries, a back channel tries to avoid oversight by the U.S. government itself. Jared Kushner reportedly proposed using Russian communication facilities for that back channel, but apparently it was never established. It's not really clear why Kushner met with Gorkov. If it's true that he suggested they use the Russians' own secure communication system to conduct their discussions, that's something beyond the pale for agency professionals, said former CIA bureau chief John Cipher. Kushner may not have broken the law, but with suspicions swirling around Trump's ties to Russia, it doesn't help the president if his closest advisor and son-in-law is a focus of the investigation. Kushner is a modern Orthodox Jew, as is his wife, Ivanka Trump. He has been given a wide range of responsibilities in the Trump White House, from restructuring the federal government to achieving Middle East peace. He was one of the architects of Trump's recent foreign trip, which especially in its visits to Saudi Arabia and Israel went smoothly and pretty much gaffe-free. Kushner is thought to be a moderating influence on Trump and Trump's policies. And the highly anticipated new Wonder Woman film is out, starring Israeli model and actress Gal Gadot as the female superhero. It looks like it's going to be a giant summer hit. The The reviews have been great, particularly for its Israeli lead actress, and early box office looks terrific. This is not the first time a Jewish actor has portrayed a superhero, by the way. Helen Slater played Supergirl way back in the 1980s. Andrew Garfield was Spider-Man in 2012. Scarlett Johansson has been the Black Widow in several films. And, of course, who could forget Paul Rudd as Ant-Man 2 summers ago? But Gal Gadot looks like a true breakthrough star, with the potential to become the biggest Israeli internationally famous actor on the screen since Natalie Portman began to make a mark in Star Wars films. Wonder Woman is a hit everywhere, except apparently in Lebanon, where the economic minister is trying to ban the film because Gal Gadot is an Israeli. Lebanon remains officially at war with Israel, and it bans Israeli products. Lebanese citizens are not allowed to travel to or have contact with Israeli citizens. Gal Gadot is 32 years old, and she does not shy away from touting her Israeli heritage and experience in the IDF. She praised the Israeli military in a widely shared Facebook post during the 2014 Gaza War. And now Gal Gadot has become a great international star of a wildly successful action film. Mazel tov. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews from around the world. We welcome back our guest, Rabbi Eve Posen, author of the new book, Pirkei Imahot, The Wisdom of Mothers, The Voices of Women, a new book that explores Jewish wisdom and the most classic text of Jewish wisdom. You have a foreword in it by Ruth Messenger, who's an old friend and a past guest of Two Jewish. That's a nice catch. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
So Lois and her husband Arden have a connection to Ruth going way back. They worked together on some social justice issues. And so when we were trying to think about where do we want the direction of the book to go, we brainstormed all of the prominent Jewish women whose wisdom we value in our lives and sort of put the call out to see if anyone was interested in working on the project with us. And Ruth took the bait and read a couple of the responses that we'd already gotten down for Pirkei Avot for the first section, and just said, it's finally time that women have a voice in our tradition. And so she was hooked on the project.
Some of the commentaries, the one, for example, I was thinking of the one about Hillel and others, are kind of general commentaries. You leave a lot of spaces for people to write their own stuff, but they don't seem to me particularly gendered. Others are much more dramatic about dealing with questions of how women see things in motherhood. Was it just sort of random? Did it evolve more in one direction than the other?
So what happened was when Lois and I were studying, we would read a Mishnah from Pirkei Avot and then stop and say whatever the first thing on our mind was. And some of them, we felt like, yeah, we totally agree with it. There's no reason to respond to them, which is why we don't have a response to every Mishnah from Pirkei Avot in there. Other ones we read and we said, you know, here's what it means to us and felt very strongly that I need to write about this. I really need to share my voice on it, just in general, not because I'm a woman, but because I'm a human being and something may have changed in the world since 225 CE. And some of them, like more women, more witchcraft, really sort of didn't jive with who we are as people and women, or don't engage in idle chatter with your wife. I really enjoy idle chatter with my husband. What we do best, I think. So we wanted to respond to that kind of a thing too. So you'll see a little bit of everything in there because that's what study is and that's what our texts are. It's really us giving a fresh lens to what our texts of our tradition are.
It seems to me that frequently when people come across a passage that says, you know, the greatest waste of time is talking to a woman, a passage you can find in the Mishnah, not just in Pirkei Avot, that often people spend a lot of time being angry about it and dealing with that. You guys don't really do that. Was that a conscious choice?
Yeah, you know, we really felt like this isn't the time to get angry and upset about it. It's simply the time to give it a fresh look with fresh eyes in our modern era. And so what we did was we just put in what felt like what felt natural to us living in our world today. So yes, back then, more women, more witchcraft, or don't engage in idle chatter was actually real because the world they were living in felt that way. We don't live in a world that way anymore. And so the response needed to be more like, beware of the words that you use, and maybe just a little tweaking of the words that the rabbis have used. Well, you'll also note that Lois and I are 45 years apart. So sometimes our responses have very much to do with our generations and where we are in our lives as well.
So I have a funny question. In chapter 5 of Pirkei Avot, there's a famous passage about what age. It's kind of Shakespeare sort of parallels it at the ages of man, but it's Yehuda ben Tema, you know, the age of 5 for this, the age of 10 for Mishnah, 13 and so on. You're the one who wrote the commentary on it, not Lois.
Mostly because I was really feeling it at the time. I was feeling like, okay, like I'm going through different stages. I get why this is going to happen. And Lois was the one sitting there going, I don't buy it. Like 5 for this, 10 for that. It doesn't really make sense to me. We you know, at this point in her life, she's done everything and seen everything multiple times. And so I sort of picked up on that because I was living it at the time.
It's funny because, you know, what she could explain about 80 and 90, and she could work her way through, you know, that process in a different way.
Maybe next time I'll make her take that one.
I think you should. I think sometimes the things we don't want to do are the things that come out the best.
It's always true.
In the process of creating this, you were engaged in an active process of study. That's always an ongoing experience, right? It, you know, it's open-ended, but a book is closed, even if it has open spaces in it. Did it ever feel strange to say, okay, now I've got it on paper, I have to move on to something else?
Not really. Lois actually still claims her 10:30 Wednesday morning time spot in my office. I told her, I said, so the book is in paper now and it's out in the world. Do you still want to meet? She goes, why wouldn't we? So we still meet every other Wednesday at 10:30 in the morning for an hour. And we text throughout the week, too. But it feels like this part of the process, the writing part was closed, but now we're doing the work of getting the book out into the world. And that feels like a whole new way to look at the text again and almost go through everything another time around. So it's exciting.
I'll ask a funny question. Maybe it's sort of a backwards ask, but there are so many copies of so many different interpretations of Pirkei Avot. Yitz Greenberg published one last year. What was your favorite, what text did you work from? What was your favorite translation, interpretation of it in preparing for this?
So we used the text actually in Sidur Sim Shalom put out by the conservative movement because it's in the Sidur that we use in our synagogue. And we wanted it to be something that if we were sitting in shul and we got bored, we could go to those familiar pages and look at our
text. If you were sitting
sort of
in shul and you got bored.
I became a rabbi because I got shpilkes in shul.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the reasons why. So we wanted the text was familiar to us, and it's primarily gender neutral, and we really wanted to stay away from anything that felt like it had too much commentary or interpretation because we wanted to be able to really respond to the words that were on the page in the Hebrew, and Lois doesn't speak Hebrew, so we needed something that was as close to the Hebrew as we could get.
So do you recommend that congregants turn to Pirkei Avot if they get bored during services? I just have to follow up.
Why not? I recommend, what I tell everyone all the time is the Siddur is there to like help guide you on your journey whenever you're there in prayer. So if the page we're on isn't speaking to you, flip a page or two and maybe it will. So I'm very much about look through the book, find what speaks to you in the moment, and use that. As long as you're not, you know, disrupting the service, I'd say go for it.
What's your next project?
We're trying to figure that out. I don't know about... Lois seems to think we're going to do a second Pirkei Imahot, which is probably going to happen at some point because she's definitely a force to be reckoned with. I am right now currently enjoying having a little bit of downtime to be with my family. This past year, I got a promotion, had a baby, and wrote a book. So it's been a little bit of a whirlwind. And next, I'm looking at writing a Jewish family Bible.
That's needed. What's the best place for people to find out more about you, more about the book?
More about me, you can go to my website, rabbieve.com. And the book, we have the website, wisdomofmothers.com. And if you go there, there's actually a spot for you to share your wisdom, too. So we're looking forward to having so many other people join the conversation with us.
It's a neat book, Pirkei Imahot, The Wisdom of Mothers, Voices of Women. I want to thank Rabbi Eve Posen for a great visit here on Two Jewish, the co-author with Lois Sussman-Shanker. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish and Me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Professor Doron Markel of the Israeli Water Authority, discussing Israel's true source of living water, the Sea of Galilee. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or stream us at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from the period of the Six-Day War, 50 years ago this week on the American calendar. The classic Ron Eliran song, composed as he traveled to sing to the Israeli troops in the Sinai, Sharm El Sheikh. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Gadol hu halayla, velach mechayech, chazarnu imboker, el Sharm El Sheikh. Avarnu balayla, bayam ubahar, umanu imboker, eletoch hameitzar. At Sharm El Sheikh, chazarnu elayich sheli, at belibenu, libenu.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.